Hope, Help, and Humanity, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The mosques of Houston opened their doors for people displaced by Tropical Storm Harvey.
It is not just like adults, healthy males, females who are there. These are elderly people. They are young kids, babies. Everybody has a different kind of need.
Plus, we get an update on flood recovery efforts in Bangladesh. And the Steve Bannon story is well known, from right-wing media boss to Trump advisor and back again. Author Joshua Green has the backstory.
He is almost what I would describe as a kind of New Age mystical seeker. You don't get that from the public portrayal of Steve Bannon, but he is very widely read in obscure religious texts.
That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. President Donald Trump traveled to Texas today to get an up-close look at the devastating damage caused by Tropical Storm Harvey. Unprecedented flooding has driven thousands out of their homes throughout the region. In the greater Houston area, some of the displaced are finding refuge inside local mosques. About a dozen mosques are welcoming people who need a place to sleep or need food and other supplies.
They're not just only people of Islamic community. We are welcoming anybody and everybody.
MJ Khan is with the Islamic Society of Greater Houston. He spoke to us from Houston after a sleepless night spent traveling from mosque to mosque to monitor relief efforts. I asked him to describe what he saw.
It is not just adults, healthy males, females who are there. These are elderly people. They are young kids, babies. So everybody has a different kind of need. We cannot have elderly people walk two floors up to find some place for them. We have to understand that babies need milk and diapers and, you know. But I think the kudos to our volunteers. They are very energetic. And, you know, like, give you an example. One person saw the kind of people coming and the families coming. He just rushed, and even he could not drive, so he just rushed to probably about mile and a half to a store, and a convenience store was the only one open. And he said, look, I need milk. And he just paid for himself and brought the milk for the babies. And before even the need was there, the supply was there. So we are seeing that kind of overtures of humanitarian gestures.
I'm curious, spending time with the people who are taking refuge at the mosques in Houston, have you met anyone who's never been to a mosque before who now finds themselves there seeking help?
Oh, yes. Especially people who are coming for supplies are the ones who are not of Islamic faith, and many of them never have stepped into a mosque. And, you know, when they come, they just are overwhelmed with the love and care they are receiving at the mosque. Our volunteers are just eager to help. And they, you know, even after 6-8 hours, you know, I ask them to, okay, take turns, and some of you should sit and rest and sleep. And no, and some, you know, I'm 67 years old, so some of them call me uncle. No, uncle, don't worry about it. We can sleep when these people are in their homes. You know, it's really bring tears to my eyes how much people are being helped. Sorry, I my voice is breaking with emotions, but
That's perfectly all right.
I've seen stories after stories where people are just pouring out their hearts in these difficult times, and it's amazing how much capacity human beings have to help and to love.
And I understand that some of your volunteers themselves have lost their home or have had to flee their homes.
Our coordinator, he's a homeless person now, and his wife has health issues herself. But in spite of that, he spent literally whole nights, last two nights, helping people. So Houstonians have a way of dealing with this. What amazes me, and this is really a model for rest of the world, that during Ike, we lost power for weeks and weeks, you know, in the Houston area. But believe me, I was on the city council of the city of Houston at that time. Our crime rate went down during those time when power was out and everybody was worried that, hey, the alarm system are not working, the businesses and people will be just looting. Even now, Our police chief is saying that there is no crime situation challenging at this time. Like I said, Houston acts like one family during these trying times, and we have seen that time and again.
MJ Khan is president of the Islamic Society of Greater Houston. Thanks for speaking with us, and I wish you well.
Well, thank you, and please ask the whole world to pray for us, pray for Houstonians. We need your prayers at this time more than anything else. And we have people with big hearts and a tremendous capacity to love and serve, and we are going through a tough time, but we appreciate everybody's well wishes and everybody's prayers.
Well, we wish you well. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You might be wondering how you can help those affected by Harvey. We've got a list of vetted charities involved in relief work in the area. Just head over to PRI.org. Some Houston residents are afraid to ask for assistance. There are 500,000 undocumented immigrants living in the area, and rumors are circulating that if they show up to storm shelters, authorities will demand to see their papers. Then there's this. On Friday, a tough new immigration law is scheduled to go into effect in Texas. Julian Aguilar has been covering the story for the Texas Tribune.
That legislation is considered the toughest state-based immigration bill in the history of the United States. What it would do is it would allow a local police officers to question the status of a person during a lawful detention, not necessarily an arrest. That doesn't even have to meet that threshold. So a lawful detention could be a traffic violation, or it could be any encounter where a peace officer asks you to pay attention to them, and that has a lot of people scared. Now, it should be noted that it does not go into effect until Friday, but it's also before a federal judge after several counties and cities in Texas sued to challenge the constitutionality of the legislation. So everybody's either waiting for 12:01 a.m. on Friday to see if this goes into effect, or for a judge, Orlando Garcia, in Bexar County in San Antonio to temporarily stop the law while it plays out in the courts.
So I imagine undocumented immigrants might be afraid to go to a shelter because they might think that a police could come in and question them.
Yes, it's a credible fear, but it should be noted that several officials have said this is not going to be an issue. We're concentrating on saving lives right now. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner gave a news conference Monday morning, and he said, if anybody comes to a shelter and somebody tries to deport them, I will represent you myself. He's an attorney. I'm not sure what his specialty is, but, you know, he made a very, very bold statement. And he said, do not worry about that. He said, I don't care your nationality, your status, your color, your creed. That does not matter. If you're a human being that needs help, please come and worry about all this immigration stuff later. He said his words said, put Senate Bill 4 on the shelf. And Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo said in Spanish, he told Spanish language media, he said, stop talking about SB4. He's like, stop putting more fear into the immigrant community. So it's very real. There are a lot of rumors going around. The city of Houston, actually, on their official Twitter account, posted a statement very, very late Monday or early Tuesday saying rumors about your status being checked at shelters is false. Please come.
What about Border Patrol? How have they been during this storm? I mean, I'm wondering if they've been they've eased up a bit on undocumented immigrants, or are they just kind of moving along?
Border Patrol from the Del Rio sector and from the Rio Grande Valley sector, they did send boats and certified medical technicians to help with the rescue effort. I mean, they sent out press releases showing all the equipment that they were going to help. And ICE and Border Patrol issued a joint statement Friday and again yesterday saying that they would suspend non-criminal immigration enforcement operations, meaning, you know, just random checks and sweeps. And those would be suspended at evacuation sites, at shelters, and at food banks.
Julian Aguilar reports on immigration for the Texas Tribune. He's based in Austin. Thanks, Julian.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay, picture this. You wake up on a Tuesday morning, reach for your phone, and there's an emergency text message from the government that says, take cover. That's what happened to people in northern Japan this morning. North Korea fired a missile over the island of Hokkaido. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe described the launch as an unprecedented threat. President Trump denounced North Korea's behavior, and he said all options are on the table for dealing with it. My BBC colleague Rupert Wingfield Hayes is in Tokyo. Rupert, just how significant is this?
Well, you know, all of these things ultimately are probably political. We think that North Korea doesn't really intend to nuke anybody else, but is using this as a bargaining chip, as a way of negotiating with the world, as a way of securing its own future, the regime's survival. However, having said that, for the people of northern Japan this morning who woke up to air raid sirens and being told to take cover in basements and concrete buildings because there was a missile heading in their direction, I don't think that's much consolation. It shook people up quite badly. It has made Japan feel extremely vulnerable. I think it's worth reminding people that Japan is no military threat to North Korea. Japan has a pacifist constitution. It has no offensive military capability. It cannot strike North Korea. And so this was an extremely aggressive act by the North Korean regime and a serious escalation of its missile testing program. It has not flown a military ballistic missile over Japan before. This is something new.
You're in Tokyo. What's the reaction there been like?
Well, the political reaction has been very strong. I've just been out on the streets of Tokyo tonight. I have to say it's rather a sort of late summer party atmosphere. No one looked particularly perturbed. There were, you know, tens of thousands of people out on the street, lots of tourists, everybody enjoying themselves. Because this flew a long way away over the north of Japan, it doesn't feel so immediate here in Tokyo. But the political reaction, as you said in your introduction, from the Prime Minister, who was clearly visibly angry, has been very strong. As I said, I think this makes Japan look very vulnerable. The Japanese government doesn't have much that it can do to respond to this. It is now, I think, looking to the United Nations and looking to the United States to stand behind Japan and, do take tough action against North Korea.
You've mentioned that Japan doesn't have many options in terms of a response. What is its formal position on how to deal with North Korea?
I said to someone today, if you ask two people to explain why North Korea is doing this, you will probably get three different answers. There is a great deal of theorizing about North Korea's motives, and that's true here in Japan as well. So, for example, I spoke to an expert at a university, at a think tank this afternoon, who said this is a demonstration to Japan that it can hit any Japanese city with a nuclear weapon now. But it's also a way of North Korea saying, if you want this to stop, you need to come to the negotiating table. I'm not so sure that's true anymore. I've been in South Korea recently talking to many, many people there. And I think the feeling is there that North Korea has shown under Kim Jong-un that it's not really interested in negotiating. It's interested in getting nuclear capability, and it will keep going until it achieves a reliable nuclear ballistic missile capability. And at that stage, it may go to the international community and say, OK, we're ready to talk, but on the basis that we keep our nuclear weapons. And that is never going to be acceptable to Japan, and it's never going to be acceptable to the United States.
My BBC colleague Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Tokyo. Thanks, Rupert.
Thank you.
The World According to Steve Bannon. That's ahead on The World.
Support for The World's podcast comes from LegalZoom. It's National Make-A-Will Month at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but they're dedicated to helping Americans take control of their family's futures with a free estate planning kit, which contains an educational ebook, LegalZoom discounts, and other helpful information. Get your free estate planning kit today at LegalZoom.com/prepare. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com/prepare.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple. Jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Steve Bannon can't just walk into the Oval Office the way he might have done just a few weeks ago. He lost his White House job, and he's back at Breitbart News. It's unclear how much power he still wields, but author Joshua Green says that Steve Bannon is not someone to be underestimated.
When I first met Bannon, I actually thought he was a grifter, a recognizable Washington character type who kind of gravitates to the hot cause. But in spending time with him, you know, I've completely changed my view. I have no doubt that he believes what he says.
Green says that Steve Bannon has a clear and coherent worldview. And to understand it, you can start with his very Catholic upbringing.
His parents in the mid-1980s became Tridentine Catholics, and those are the Catholics who attend Latin Mass. It is a conservative form of Catholicism that was reintroduced by Pope John Paul II in the 1980s that wound back some of the Vatican II reforms. And Bannon's high school is actually a right-wing Catholic military high school. There aren't a lot of those, but the curriculum that he learned really emphasized the history of Western civilization through a Catholic lens. And in speaking to some of Bannon's classmates, they were taught that Christendom for millennia has been at war with Islam, that back in the 1500s, Ferdinand and Isabella, the Catholic monarchs in Spain, saved Christendom by repelling the Moor invaders, Muslims. And so Bannon was taught from a very early age to have this kind of apocalyptic worldview that said the Judeo-Christian West, in particular, was always under danger of assault and that Catholics had to be very vigilant in guarding against that.
Bannon then joined the Navy in the late 1970s. He served as an officer on a destroyer in the Persian Gulf during the run-up to the Iran hostage crisis. And President Jimmy Carter's botched attempt to rescue those hostages seems to have had a big impact on Bannon. Why?
Well, Bannon told me that he wasn't very political before he went in the Navy. His family were blue-collar, Irish Catholic, Kennedy-loving Democrats. But his destroyer was in the Persian Gulf and was involved in the build-up to the failed American attempt to rescue the Iranian hostages. And Bannon was both so disgusted with what he saw as Jimmy Carter's ineptitude, and also, I think, radicalized by what he perceived to be the threat of radical Islam, that here these radical Islamic students had taken control of the U.S. embassy. And this was the sort of threat that I think Bannon believed he'd been taught about in high school, that this was a real threat to his way of life. And it was clear in talking to him over a number of years that this was a radicalizing moment for Bannon.
But on the other hand, while in the Navy, you write that Bannon also began a systematic study of the world's religions and that he carried on for more than a decade. He briefly practiced Buddhism before wending his way back to Catholicism. So he seems kind of, he's a curious guy.
I mean, Bannon is a fascinating and curious guy, and he is almost what I would describe as a kind of New Age mystical seeker. You don't get that from the public portrayal of Steve Bannon, but he is very widely read in obscure religious texts and told me he spent about 10 years during his time in the Navy and afterwards essentially reading himself through a tour of the world's religions. And this led him to some very odd and unusual influences. The primary one being his personal guru, a guy named René Guénon, who was an early 20th century French metaphysician who was raised a Roman Catholic, later practiced occultism and Freemasonry, but became the founder of a strain of theology called primordial traditionalism, which held that certain unifying religious truths were revealed to mankind in the earliest ages of the world, but that these have been basically lost by the rise of modernity since the Enlightenment. So Bannon, who is someone prone to very grandiose view of himself and his place in history, told me he really does believe that the world has been in decline since about the 1500s, and that one of the things that drives his politics and that drives what is obviously an apocalyptic worldview is this belief that the world is in the midst of a dark age and that we need to fight back against that.
You've spent a lot of time with Steve Bannon. You had long conversations. Does he truly believe that Western civilization is on the verge of collapse?
I think he does. And I don't think it's all just an act or for show, because there are examples of him talking about this sort of thing, going back years before Trump was really on the scene. There was a now infamous video of Bannon at a Vatican conference, which was thrown by a very conservative Catholic sort of splinter group in 2013, 2014, where he talks about all these things. He talks about some of his intellectual influences, people like Julius Evola, the fascist racial theorist Mussolini in the 1930s, who believed that the world was entering a dark age and that there wasn't this religious reawakening, that the world was rapidly heading toward decline.
The thing that puzzles me about Bannon is he is somebody, as you say, he's had a lot of different experiences in his life, the military, Wall Street, Washington power broking. He's arguably lived lived in a wider variety of environments than many of us. Yet he really does have this sense that we're in a dark age and religion's going to be the answer. It just doesn't sort of compute.
Yeah. To me, in talking to Bannon, it really goes back to two things. One is this religious worldview, this view, this primordial traditionalist view he has that ever since the 1500s, the world has been in a state of decline. And I know it sounds very, very odd and sort of like something out of the Da Vinci Code, but part of Bannon's beliefs, part of Guignon's beliefs was the idea that time moves in cycles. And we know from all sorts of public interviews Bannon has given that he's really captivated by the Hindu concept of cyclical time. One of the movies Bannon made in 2010 was based on a book called The Fourth Turning, which has a similar sort of idea that America goes through periodic cycles of crisis and awakening. And Bannon's contention, this is a 2010 movie he did called Generation Zero on the financial crisis, was that the collapse of the global economy in 2009 and 2010 kind of heralded this slide into a dark age that Bannon's religion told him was coming.
Steve Bannon's now out of the White House, back at Breitbart. What power does he still wield?
Given that we have really critical bills that need to pass Congress in September, I think it's going to be a real test of how influential Bannon and his splinter group of nationalist Republicans can be in Congress, because he's made it clear to me and to other folks that he intends on going after the Republican leaders in the House and Senate, Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, to try and inhibit them from doing things like carrying on government funding without radical cuts and without funding for the border wall and all sorts of things that are going to be very difficult for Republicans to pass. And I also think it's a reason that now that Bannon is outside the White House and is going to continue to try and exert his influence, that the divisions within the Republican Party, that the divisions between the White House and the Republican Congress are actually going to deepen, and it's going to be harder for Trump to get things done now with Bannon outside the White House than it was when Bannon was inside the White House.
Joshua Green is the author of Devil's Bargain, Steve Bannon, Donald Trump, and the Storming of the Presidency. Thanks for being with us, Joshua.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. Ahead, a new religious cleansing ceremony for former ISIS sex slaves.
It's a good feeling.
It's amazing.
Plus, building tomorrow's machines today.
It does sound like science fiction because it is quite mad. Like, it's going to be very hard to do.
That's here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Libya is the major transit point for African migrants trying to reach Europe. It's where they board rickety boats to try and cross the Mediterranean. And if they're caught, they end up back there. While in Libya, migrants often find themselves in informal camps, which have been described as hell on earth. Belle True is a journalist with the Times of London. She's recently returned from Libya. We caught up with her in Cairo. Belle, you were granted extremely rare access to one of the centers where migrants are being held. Can you describe what they're like?
Well, it's really hard to describe really just the horrific conditions that these migrants and refugees are being held in. We're talking about airless, windowless warehouses in soaring temperatures of sort of 45, 46 degrees Celsius, with hundreds of people in these rooms. And they're often there for months at a time because they are waiting to be repatriated home. Libya doesn't have a system for people to be able to seek asylum. So if they do arrest migrants or refugees, unless the UNHCR intervenes, they're basically repatriated home. And that takes months and months and months because of the chaos in Libya. So you've got hundreds and hundreds of people living in squalid warehouses without any air, with very little to do with their time, and receiving food that really isn't good enough quality because these detention centres are woefully underfunded, basically just sitting there all day. Sometimes you also have abuse from the detention centre guards as well, although the Libyan authorities at the moment are trying to stop that. But we're just talking about essentially overflowing, squalid, horrific rooms.
So you mentioned 46 degrees Celsius, which is like 110 degrees Fahrenheit. It just sounds incredible. I want to focus for a moment on one of the people you met there in the detention camp. He's a young South Sudanese man named Hennessy. Here's a clip of him talking about his ordeal so far.
We saw people getting shot. It was just so traumatizing to us. It was just absolutely horrible. I can't go home. I just hope there's a solution. I just hope, because I've never hated my life this much. It's just terrible. Just one day here is just hell.
He said one day here is hell. Why is he even there? He sounds like he's straight out of London.
Absolutely. Well, I was quite surprised when I bumped into him in this huge room that was filled with about 700 men who were crushed together in the searing heat of the day. I was very surprised to hear him speaking at me with a perfect London accent. As it turned out, he used to live in London for several years as a child with his father, who was actually a doctor in a private clinic there. Through a series of terrible events, he ended up back in Amsterdam. His father's visa expired. His father developed a drug habit and then ended up dying. And so Hennessy basically ended up back in South Sudan in the middle of the war. After his father died, his uncle took care of him and accused him of being homosexual and threatened to kill him. So he had to flee, basically, for his own life. He sold everything he had. He went to Egypt and then Libya with the hope of getting on one of those boats to Italy. And as soon as he arrived in the country, he was kidnapped by two separate militias. He was tortured. The militias were trying to torture him to make money out of him, to get his family to pay up. And it wasn't until the UN-backed authorities essentially discovered this detention centre that he was freed under gunfire. So it's an extraordinary story. He's just 18 years old. He should be in his high school exams, but instead he's sitting in this overflowing detention centre.
So what are his prospects?
Well, at the moment, we are actually trying to put forward an asylum case. He has a very strong asylum case. He's young. He was just 17 when he fled to Libya first. He's obviously faced extreme circumstances like torture and kidnapping. He's fleeing a country that is in a conflict, and he has his own personal reasons to not go home.
I know part of the reason for these squalid camps is the fact that the EU is trying to stop the flow of migrants onto European shores. What are they doing?
Well, absolutely, as you said, what appears to be one of the main aims of the European Union and Europe is just to basically keep the migrants in North Africa and not on their shores. So at the moment, their policy is to try and empower the Libyan Coast Guard and the Libyan authorities to essentially arrest and detain migrants as they come into Libya or as they're trying to cross to Italy and keep them in detention centres to be repatriated.
Belle True of the London Times, speaking to us from Cairo. We've heard a lot about the pain and suffering the Islamic State has brought to Iraq and Syria, but the group has been troubling other countries as well. The tiny Mediterranean nation of Lebanon, which borders Syria, has been fighting an ISIS presence for years in a rugged frontier area. But as of today, the group has finally been kicked out, and it did something it has never done before. It surrendered. Our Middle East correspondent, Rich Hall, is normally based in Lebanon, but today he's right here in our Boston studio. Rich, ISIS surrendering. Is this really a first?
It is kind of, yeah. There have been smaller incidents when ISIS has been allowed to retreat. They've been offered a way out and they've taken it. But you only have to look at what happened in Mosul, where they fought to the death to see what they normally do. So this was kind of an unusual thing, and the scene was kind of unusual. There were around 600 ISIS fighters who were bussed out of this area, though, where they've been for 3 years, on these air-conditioned buses that had Happy Journey on the side of them. And there's these amazing pictures of these ISIS fighters looking out from the bus being led away. The Lebanese army is calling it a surrender, but it's actually more of a relocation. They're being taken to eastern Syria. It's kind of a transfer there. And there's this great comment from one of the generals, Lebanese generals involved in the negotiation here. He said, "The return of Daesh militants in air-conditioned cars to their countries is permissible because Lebanon adheres to the philosophy of a state that does not exact revenge."
That doesn't sound like a surrender. It sounds like an agreement to move people somewhere else. But remind us where they have been in Lebanon. Where has ISIS been till this so-called surrender?
So, yeah, things really began in Lebanon in 2014, but that's when it began heating up. So there's always been this worry in Lebanon of the spillover from the Syrian civil war. It's right next door. Lebanon's a small country. It, too, has a large Sunni population, and it was a largely Sunni uprising in Syria. So there's always been this concern. And then in 2014, a few years into the war, ISIS and al-Qaeda overran a town on the border, a Lebanese town. They took it over, and they kidnapped 30 Lebanese soldiers. And this began this sort of really huge ordeal in Lebanon. These soldiers were kidnapped by these groups. No one knew their fate. Many of them were killed. Only 16 made it back in the end. And so for 3 years now, they've been dealing with this ISIS presence on the border. There have been ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And finally, it looks as though it's coming to an end.
I'm still puzzled about agreeing to move the ISIS soldiers. Why aren't they captured and their weapons taken?
Yeah, this is actually quite controversial. So the reason they were allowed to leave was it was in return for a deal in which the Lebanese would get back the bodies of 9 soldiers who were kidnapped by them. So they get the remains of these soldiers. But a lot of people are angry. There are a lot of Iraqis who are angry on social media because these fighters are essentially being moved from the Lebanon-Syria border to the Syria-Iraq border. And who's to say they can't cause them a problem over there? In Iraq, they kill them or they arrest them. So there's a sense that they're just moving the problem away from them.
Did they even take their weapons away?
They were allowed light weapons. They had to burn all their heavy weapons. But yeah, they were allowed to take guns. So you can see why some people would be angry. Even in Lebanon, some people are angry about this as well.
Now, the Lebanese army, they're not only concerned about ISIS and now they've moved them. They've got Hezbollah there too. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this is kind of an awkward question for the US in the region especially. So this battle was fought by the Lebanese army, and it was also fought by Hezbollah, which is a militant group inside of Lebanon. It's a militant group that was founded to kick Israel out of Lebanon during the Lebanese Civil War. It's also a designated terror group in the US. So the US funds the Lebanese army to kind of act as a bulwark against Hezbollah, to make it the strongest power in Lebanon and to fight ISIS. But what we're seeing at the moment is the Lebanese army almost fighting alongside Hezbollah to kick ISIS out, which obviously would create some concern in the US because they're giving all this money to the Lebanese army and here they are fighting alongside this terror group.
Has the US weighed in on the fact that Hezbollah was involved in this extrication of the ISIS militants?
They've actually been very quiet. I did contact the State Department yesterday, and I asked them about this. Aren't you concerned that this money is going to the Lebanese army to act as a counter to Hezbollah, but they're fighting alongside them? There's kind of this willful ignorance, I think, on all sides. The State Department sent me back this answer, said they have long expressed concern about Hezbollah's military operations in Lebanon. They don't specifically address it. And it's funny, this debate's taking place in Lebanon as well. The Lebanese army is denying that it's fighting alongside Hezbollah, even though this operation was launched at the same time. They're fighting from different sides. The Lebanese have a great sense of humor. That was this hashtag, oh, what a coincidence. And it was just pictures of the Lebanese army and Hezbollah fighters alongside each other. It was kind of like, oh, what a coincidence we're here at the same time. It's like, fancy seeing you here in the middle of nowhere.
The world's Middle East correspondent, Rich Hall. Great to see you, Rich.
Thanks for having me.
ISIS is on the run in Iraq, too. U.S.-backed Iraqi forces say they've retaken the city of Mosul and most of Tal Afar, one of the last strongholds of the Islamic State group, also known as IS. The human toll of ISIS occupation has been immense. In 2014, IS captured several thousand Yazidi women and girls and began trading them as sex slaves. Yazidis who've managed to escape are starting to rebuild their lives. And for some women, that process starts with a new spiritual ceremony. Our BBC colleague Yolande Nell reports from northern Iraq.
In a small cave-like room, an elderly Yazidi woman in a turban is pouring holy water and praying over Shireen, who's 23, and 16-year-old Iman. We're at Lalish, the Yazidi sacred site in the mountains of the north of Iraq. But this isn't one of the Yazidis' centuries-old religious rites. It's an entirely modern invention.
Before they wouldn't have accepted us, but now they do, and they respect us even more than they did before.
Until recently, these friends were held as sex slaves by IS. In the past, such an ordeal would have forced them to leave their faith. Now, this ceremony marks their rebirth as Yazidis.
It's a good feeling.
It's amazing.
With their esoteric beliefs that include devotion to a peacock angel, IS described the Yazidi as devil worshippers. Over the centuries, they've endured waves of violence. But Khadr Domali at the University of Duhok says this was on a different scale.
More than 68 Yazidis temples been destroyed, 43 mass graves, and still we have more than 3,200 women and children in the captivities. I think there are no other community in the world like Yazidis. If you live with some people for hundreds of years and immediately he become like barbarian to kidnap women and girls and use them for the sexual slavery, what happened is really huge, you cannot describe.
3 years ago, helicopters struggled to reach some 100,000 Yazidis who'd fled to Mount Sinjar when IS fighters attacked their villages. Men who didn't escape were murdered, boys taken as soldiers, and women and girls sold as the chattels of war.
I've come now to Khanka camp outside the Hook, and in the stifling heat, there are only children out and about. This is a vast sprawl of tents. It's been here for 3 years now, and I've come to see again Iman and Shireen, who I met in Lalish. Shireen, we've just come inside your tent. What's happened to your family?
All my family has been split up. My brothers were kidnapped. We still have one sister who is captive with IS. And my father is also missing.
And Iman, tell me, why are more people not going back to Mount Sinjar, to their villages?
We're still afraid to go back. We've heard that our village has been liberated, but all the houses have been totally destroyed. Some were destroyed by IS and others by the airstrikes.
The UN now describes what's happened to the Yazidis as genocide. And here in Duhok, the Yazda charity is pushing for justice and collecting testimonies. This month, Baghdad finally agreed the Security Council could send investigators to gather evidence of the most serious IS crimes. Yazda's Iraq director is Sylvia Zanino.
It's hugely important. I hear that the community is not ready for reconciliation until there's some kind of justice. And I think it's quite understandable. So it is a necessary step towards rebuilding some kind of peace or coexistence in the region.
Back at Lalish, families take comfort in Yazidi rituals as they try to rebuild their lives. There's a moment of joy when a baby is baptized. And for the next generation of all Iraqis, what happens now is key. A test for both international justice and national reconciliation in a country where IS exploited and deepened sectarian divisions.
The BBC's Yolande Nell reporting from Iraq. Texas isn't the only place dealing with record-shattering floods. South Asia is going through one of its worst monsoon seasons in recent history. An estimated 1,200 people have died in northern India, Nepal, and Bangladesh. Thousands more are cut off from food and water. Matthew Merrick is the head of disaster response in Bangladesh with the International Red Cross. He recently did a flyover of some of the most affected areas.
Basically, as far as the eye can see when you're up there, floods are everywhere. The riverbanks have broken. To put it into some perspective, Bangladesh has 64 districts, and half of those are flooded. So you could technically say that half of the entire country, 167 million people, half of the country is flooded.
What have you been seeing and hearing from people you're trying to help?
When the floods first hit now about 10 days ago, they were much higher than they are now. You're having waters starting to recede from certain areas. But we've been out in the field and people are getting on with life on a regular basis. I was pretty amazed the other day when we visited Achar, which is kind of the sandbar island in and around and sometimes right smack dab in the middle of the Jumuna River. People prepared pretty well to save their assets, including livestock, meaning that they actually built up platforms of earth to make sure that their cows, their goats were taken care of. You can sense just from the numbers of fatalities in Bangladesh how well prepared people were. Unfortunately, about 140 people have passed away, but compared to decades ago when thousands and thousands were losing their lives from flooding, this, even though it's an unprecedented flooding event, people are much better off.
What kind of rescue efforts are you coordinating?
Right now, the focus is not on rescue. The focus is on actually delivering aid, food, clean drinking water, as well as assistance in the form of hygiene items, etc.
You mentioned that 20 years ago, this kind of flooding caused way more damage and deaths. What's happened in the past 20 years to make Bangladesh a safer place in terms of impact of floods?
I think we have to acknowledge global development. I think we have to acknowledge the economic advances. Bangladesh has benefited from those. I think we have to recognize, at least as a Red Cross movement, that we've gotten better coordinated and we've taken advantage of the peace times when there are not mega disasters and work with our partner national societies to better prepare people and make them aware of these things.
Based on the damage you're seeing, how much do you think that recovery and rebuilding will cost in Bangladesh?
We ourselves have requested 4.7 million Swiss francs from the international community to do the operations that we want to do. And that's focusing on some of the most affected districts. And we want to continue to reach over 100,000 people in the coming weeks with direct emergency relief assistance. That's in the form, again, of clean drinking water, of food, as well as cash assistance where necessary. It's really hard to predict the actual cost. I haven't myself seen the government release any national damage estimates. I haven't seen a massive amount of destruction of infrastructure, but there has been an enormous amount of destruction of croplands. So I think any calculation is going to have to take a look at, you know, what impact that has on the local food consumption.
You're probably aware that here in the States, everybody's focused on Tropical Storm Harvey and what's happening in Houston. Sitting in Bangladesh, do you have any thoughts or any kind of observations about how a place like Houston and how the U.S. deals with its own catastrophe?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts. First, I actually have family in Houston. I have aunts and uncles and first cousins in Houston, so I know it's a direct concern. But you cannot compare Bangladesh to Texas or Dhaka to Houston. As much as somebody suffers in the northern region of Bangladesh, they're no more or no less suffering than the people in Houston. It's personal. The scale can be completely different. The city's ability and the individual's ability to rebound and survive from the disaster might be different. But I think in general, you know, it's a very individual experience. I myself have lived through a number of them, and you can't say one is greater or less than the other.
That's Matthew Merrick, Bangladesh Disaster Manager with the International Red Cross. Thanks, Matthew.
Thanks, Carol.
Finally today, a futuristic vision of getting from point A to point B. Can you imagine sitting inside a pod blasting through a vacuum tube at 700 miles per hour? If so, take heart. It's called the Hyperloop, and thinkers from around the world want to make it a reality. Recently, some of them gathered in Southern California at SpaceX. That's the rocket design company owned by Elon Musk. Working in teams, they competed for the chance to test their prototype capsules in an actual Hyperloop tube. My BBC colleague Regan Morris was there.
Through, zwei, eins.
That's billionaire Elon Musk counting down in Swiss German to launch a pod from Switzerland down the nearly mile-long Hyperloop tube he created in Los Angeles.
All right, congratulations to the Swiss team completing a successful Hyperloop run. Well done, guys.
He built this tube right next to his office at SpaceX. It's 6 feet in diameter, and the pods today, they're traveling without people or cargo. This is a test. Musk is the entrepreneur behind Tesla cars and SpaceX. He created the Hyperloop concept and is hosting this competition to accelerate development of functional Hyperloop pod prototypes. The contest was simple in one way.
The fastest pod wins.
Steve Davis is the director of advanced projects at SpaceX.
This competition started last September, which means in 11 months, these student teams went from nothing, no design, no hardware, no testing, to fully functional Hyperloop pods. So congratulations to the students for pulling that off.
Hyperloop believers imagine a world of 30-minute commutes between LA and San Francisco or London to Glasgow. Even the students here can see that the concept does sound a little nutty. Macaulay Versi is from the University of Edinburgh's Hyperloop team.
It does sound like science fiction because it is quite mad. Like, it's going to be very hard to do. But that's the point. It's a challenge. That's why we're all here. That's why we're trying. That's why we don't sleep. That's why we spend all this money and all our time and effort to do it. Because if someone does crack it, it will revolutionize transportation forever.
One, launch.
Ultimately, it was a student team from the Technical University of Munich in Germany who won the competition. Elon Musk was impressed.
Hey, congratulations to the war team. That was an amazing job. That pod just went 324 kilometers an hour, over 200 miles an hour. I think what this is really all about is advancing the state of transportation, trying new things that have never been done before that can make an incredible difference to people's lives. The reason I love these things is because it makes me excited to wake up in the morning. And you need these things. You need these things. There's a lot of problems in the world, but if we don't have things that inspire us, what's the point of living?
Whoa, deep thoughts from Elon Musk, ending that report by the BBC's Regan Morris. That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.